and one as three copies of 000 minus 111. And you remember to determine its error syncrome, we decided we had to measure the eight operators that I wrote up before. Okay, so the 9-qubit code has three sets of three, and within each set of three, we can correct a bit flip error, right? By measuring whether one of the qubits is different in the z basis from the other two, and to do that, we measure these pairs of things, right? And we look at the eigenvalues here, plus one or minus one, and that will tell us which of the three is different from the others. Okay, remember that part. And then we have three phases. And the three phases are supposed to all be the same too, either plus, 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 or minus, minus, minus. And so again, we want to say how one of them is different from the others. And to do that, we measure the eigenvalues of these two operators, six x's and six, well, x's on 1 through 6, and x's on 4 through 9. And each set of three will give us a phase plus 1 or minus 1, depending on what the sign is. And so two sets of three for the correct code words will give us an eigenvalue plus one. But if there's been one phase that's switched in one of the sets of three, then one or both of these will change, because we'll have one plus sign and one minus sign. So we'll have eigenvalues minus one for one or both. And which one of these two operators is eigenvalue minus one, that tells us where the phase has been flipped. Okay? And then, so that's the x and y, the x and z errors. Then if we have a y error, that's both an x and a z error on the same qubit. So it shows up in both parts. OK? Other questions? OK, so remember, we had these eight operators, and we defined, we noticed that while the correct code words had eigenvalue plus one for these things, we could also use any product of these, and it would still have eigenvalue plus one. And so we define the stabilizer. As the set of poly operators, meaning Pn being, remember, tensor products of poly operators on n qubits, such that m psi is equal to psi for all code words psi. And you can do this for the 9-qubit code, but also for really any other code. So any quantum code is going to be a subspace of a bigger Hilbert space. And so the subspace consists of these code words. And then we can define this thing for that subspace. Now, for some subspaces, this is not a very sensible thing to do. But for other subspaces, it's really a very sensible thing. And for the 9-qubit code, it turns out that the stabilizer exactly characterizes the subspace and the code that we're dealing with. And so there's a lot of other codes that have this property. And stabilizers are, as you can see in the case of the 9-bit code, useful for understanding error correction properties. So we're going to think a lot more about stabilizers today. So first of all, what are the properties of the stabilizer? So let's see what they want, right? So the main one is that once you define this for any code, then you'll see that the stabilizer is an abelian group. Okay? And there's two sides to that. First of all, that it's a group, and second of all, that's an abelian. So there's two things we have to show. So first, we have to show that it's a group. And to do that, we have to show that it's closed under multiplication. So we want to say that if m and n are in the stabilizer, that implies that mn is in the stabilizer. Well, that's easy to show, because if we take mn psi, that's how we're going to test if it's in the stabilizer. We want it to be equal to psi. And indeed, mn psi is equal to m. Well, n is in the stabilizer, so n psi is equal to psi. So this is equal to m psi. M is in the stabilizer too, so this is just equal to psi. Okay? So that's right. That's what we wanted. And that's true for any code word psi. Okay? So that shows that mn is in the stabilizer. And then we have to show it's abelian. In other words, we have to show that if m and n are in the stabilizer, then m and n commute. Okay, well, how can we do that? Well, we notice that mn psi is equal to psi. But this logic is equally true if we take the other order. So this is equal to nm psi. Okay, so that tells us that the commutator nm applied to psi is equal to 0. Now, for general n and m, this doesn't tell you that n and m commute. It just means that the commutator has some null space, and the state psi lives within that null space. But in the specific case of poly operators, well, the commutator of two poly operators is just going to be another poly operator, you know, with a factor of 2 in front. And so this commutator can never have a trivial null space unless it's actually 0. Okay, and so this tells us that nm equals 0 because n and m are poly operators. Okay? So S is an abelian group. And that makes sense, right, thinking of what you know about eigenstates and operators. Right, we usually imagine that two operators can only have a simultaneous eigenvalue if they commute. And again, it's not literally true, but certainly in the case of poly operators, it is. That's exactly what we're insisting here. We're insisting that the code words be simultaneous plus one eigenvectors of all of the operators in the stabilizer. Okay. That make sense? Okay. So since stabilizers are so helpful, actually it turns out that it's frequently better to go the other way. So rather than say we have some quantum error correcting code defined by subspace, let's figure out the stabilizer from that, it actually makes sense to say, well, let's just make up a stabilizer and think about the quantum error correcting code that corresponds to that stabilizer. So how do we do that? Well, we have to define what the code corresponding to a stabilizer is. So what are the properties of a stabilizer? Well, we have a subgroup of the poly group. And it should be an abelian subgroup, right? Because that's always going to be the case for a stabilizer. And we need one more kind of silly condition, which is that minus the identity is not in S. Because we're going to want S to be the set of operators that have plus one eigenvalue. And minus the identity never has plus one eigenvalue. Okay, so this can't be in it. But this is enough. And then given that, we can say define a subspace, which I guess I'll call T of S, to be the set of state psi such that m psi equals psi for all m and s. Okay, so this defines a subspace, and clearly this definition is closely related to this one. Yeah.
So minus I is not
I inverse. Minus I is what?
Is not I inverse.
It's not I inverse. No, I is the identity.
Right.
So I inverse is I.
Yeah, but.
Right. If you think of the additive group for matrices, then zero would be the additive identity.
Right.
And minus I would then be the additive inverse. But we're thinking about multiplication of matrices. Questions? Other questions? OK, so
So what is T of S?
What is T of S? What do you mean? This is the definition.
Okay.
So it's a subspace. It's a set of states.
Okay.
And the states with this property.
So T of S is a subspace.
Yeah. So basically what T of S is, it's the intersection of the plus one eigenspaces of all of the operators in S. So it's the states that are plus one eigen states for everything in the stabilizer. Okay. It is a subspace. You can see that pretty easily because each of those eigenspaces is a subspace and we're taking the intersection of them. So for instance, if you have psi plus phi and psi and phi both satisfy this, then the sum will satisfy too, for instance. Okay, are there questions?
So T of S doesn't have like some specific name.
I see. Well, it's I guess you could call it the code space. I mean, in some sense, it is the quantum error correcting code, so that's another thing you could call it. But frequently, in some cases, we don't even bother because it turns out it's just easier to deal with the stabilizer for most things. So when we do this, well, what are the properties of this code space? Well, one thing that's obvious is how many qubits are involved, right? We define that already all the way at the beginning because we're dealing with subgroups of Pn. So that's n qubit Pauli operators. And so that means that this code space is going to involve n physical qubits. Okay, but it's some complicated subspace of that, and we want to know, for instance, how many encoded qubits there are. The 9-qubit code only encoded 1 qubit, but you can come up with codes that encode more. So we have the following result. So the dimension of this code space is 2 to the k, where k equals n minus r, when r is the number of generators of S. Okay, what do I mean by generators of S? I mean the smallest set of things so that everything in S can be written as a product of those generators. Okay, so in the case of the 9-qubit code, these 8 things, each row being one operator, are the generators of the stabilizer for the 9-qubit code. Okay, and plugging into the formula, you see that's correct, right? We have 8 generators and 9 qubits, so k is equal to 1. We have 1 encoded qubit. Okay, so it's 2 to the 1 dimensional, right? A 2-dimensional Hilbert space. And the intuition behind this is, I think, fairly straightforward. Each Pauli has a plus one eigenspace and a minus one eigenspace. And so each time you add a generator to the stabilizer, you're dividing the Hilbert space in half, right? Because you're dividing into the plus one and minus one eigenspace. And so you start out with a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. But then if you add r generators, you divide it in half r times. So you have a 2 to the n minus r dimensional Hilbert space that's left over as the plus one eigenspace of all of those r generators. Okay. Just checking that a state as plus one eigenvalue for the generators, that's sufficient. Because, well, basically by this argument, if it has plus one eigenvalue for the generators, it'll have plus one eigenvalue for the product of generators. Right? So that's enough. The other ones, the rest of these conditions for the non-generators fall automatically. Okay? So what I told you about dividing subspace in half, that's not a proof. Because you know it's possible that these eigenspaces intersect at weird angles or something. But for Pauli operators, that doesn't happen. So that's another reason it's nice to use the Pauli group. And therefore, we do, in fact, get this formula. OK? So there are questions on this. OK, so of course, the main reason we're interested in error correcting codes are because they correct errors. So how does a stabilizer help to tell us about correcting errors? Maybe I can put that all the way up there. So think about the 9-qubit code here. We have the stabilizer. And the stabilizer definitely is telling us something about the errors, right? Because the eigenvalues of the stabilizer generators are telling us whether there's been errors or not. If we have a correct code word that's in the original code, we have plus one eigenvalue for all of the generators. Whereas if we have an error, well, then we have minus one eigenvalues for some of the generators. And moreover, which generators have minus one eigenvalues tell us information about where those errors are. Okay? And that same thing is going to be true in general. But we can narrow down precisely what information they're giving us. So in the case of the 9-qubit code, the Z operators, they were telling us about bit flip errors, okay, on the qubits that they involved. And the X operators, they're telling us about phase flip errors, Z errors. Okay? And so the key thing here is that X and Z anti-commute. So that's why the Zs tell us about X errors and the X tell us about Z errors. And so that we can generalize by considering a case. So suppose we have some M in the stabilizer, and then there's some error. And suppose that, do the other one first. Suppose that E and M anti-commute. Okay. So let's look at the eigenvalue of E psi under M. Well, ME is equal to minus EM. And M is in the stabilizer. So M psi is equal to psi. So this is equal to minus E psi. So E has changed. So psi was a plus one eigenstate of M. But E psi is a minus one eigenstate of M. So if we have an error that anti-commutes with M, it switches us from plus one to a minus one eigenstate. And let's consider the other case. Remember, these are polys, so we have only two choices, that E and M anti-commute or that E and M commute. So what happens if they commute? Well, in that case, M E psi is equal to E M psi, and M psi is equal to psi. So in this case, E psi stays a plus one eigenstate. Okay, so we can kind of see a pattern here. So the information that we're getting from the error syndrome, the eigenvalues of the generators, that tells us which of these generators the error that occurred commutes with. Okay, and so if we can pick the generators appropriately, we can get a lot of information about what the errors are. And then so that's what we want to do to design a stabilizer code. We come up with a bunch of generators and try to find generators such that they'll anti-commute in unique ways with a bunch of different errors. That gives us information about the errors and lets us correct them. Okay, so in particular, we can define the normalizer of S to be equal to the set of M such that Mn equals 0 for all n in S. Okay, so this is the set of operators that commute with everything in the stabilizer. Okay, and this is an interesting thing to consider because this is exactly the set of things which will leave us always with plus one eigenvalue when we apply them to state. So this is a set of errors that can't be detected by the code, right? Because if you apply them to the code, well, to any code word, the error synchron will be trivial. You'll get all plus one eigenvalues. Okay, so we won't have a way to detect that. But actually, it's a little bit narrower than that. So this is the set of errors with trivial synchron. But actually, the set of detectable errors is n of s minus s, or undetectable errors. So you understand why something in n of s, in general, would be undetectable, right? Because the syndrome is trivial, so we have no information that would tell us about it. But why minus s? Well, so if we have an operator an error e that's actually in s, then well, e applied to the state psi is just equal to psi again, right? That's the definition of s. Okay, so e is not really an error, because it acts like the identity on code words. Okay, so n of s minus s is important. This is a set of things that leave us in the code that have trivial error syndrome, but don't leave the code words invariant. So n of s minus s is a set of operators that do something non-trivial to code words. Okay? Are there questions on that? Yeah. What do people? Yeah. So far I'm only talking about detecting errors. So this is just the first step. And the next thing we'll say is, well, what about correcting them? So this is going to tell us, by looking whether the error that occurred is in n of s minus s, we're going to be able to tell that an error occurred or not. So if an error is outside n of s minus s, so it's outside n of s, say, then we'll see that something happened. Okay, but that's just the first step to correcting it, of course.
But if it's inside n of s?
Well, if it's inside n of s, so if it's inside s, so s is always inside n of s, right? Because S is an abelian group, and this is a set of everything that commutes. So if it's inside S, then, well, we won't know that it happened, but actually nothing happened, right? Because it acts like the identity. But if it's inside N of S, but not in S, then that means that we won't be able to tell that something happened, because it'll change one code word, or has the possibility of changing one code word into a different code word.
Code words.
Well, it depends on the code, whether that's inside or not.
Right. But that's not detected.
Right. So if it's changing one code word to a different code word, well, that there's no way we can detect that, right? Because we don't know that it wasn't the original code word. It wasn't the original state to start with. Right? We don't know what the original state was. Otherwise, you know, there'd be no point in doing this. We just throw it all away and make it ourselves. OK? So there are other questions about this? OK, so then the next step is, again, to correct errors. So how do we correct errors? Well, so the result is that stabilizer S, the code corresponding to it, can correct a set E of errors if and only if E dagger F is outside N of S minus S for all pairs E, F, and E. So polys are Hermitian, so the dagger is not really doing anything. But it's when you start to generalize it, you want that dagger in there, so it's just convenient to put it. So basically what it's saying is that the products of pairs of errors should be detectable. So why is that? Well, what we'd like to be able to do is we'd like to be able to say, we've measured the error syndrome. That gives us a set of eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. And that error syndrome is going to uniquely tell us what the error is. The set of possible errors is E. So for instance, E might be the set of all 1 qubit poly errors, probably the identity plus 1 qubit poly errors. Or if it's a code that corrects 2 errors, it might be the identity plus all 1 or 2 qubit poly errors. You can also come up with other weirder sets E that will correct, for instance, it might correct bit flip errors on 1 or 2 qubits, but only phase errors on 1 qubit, for instance. Okay, so we have some set E, and we'd like to say that the error syndrome for the actual error will tell us uniquely what error occurred in E. Okay, so let's think about that. How can that happen? Well, in particular, E and F have the same error syndrome. If and only if they commute with the same subset of the stabilizer, and in particular, the same subset of the generators. Okay. And what that means is that if you look at the product E dagger F, that E dagger F, if you think of any M in the stabilizer and try to see whether it commutes or anti-commutes with E dagger F, well, suppose it commutes with E, then in this case, it also commutes with F. And so it commutes with the product E dagger F. On the other hand, if it anti-commutes with E, it must also anti-commute with F, which means that it commutes with the product E dagger F. Okay? So either way, E dagger F commutes with M for all M in the stabilizer. And what that means is that E dagger F is in N of S. Okay? So this is the bad case. When E and F have the same error syndrome, we can't distinguish them. And so we don't know which error to correct. And that happens exactly when E dagger F is in N of S. On the other hand, if E dagger F is not in N of S, then that means that E and F have different error syndromes, and we can distinguish them. Okay? So what about the other side of this? Well, what about the minus S? So this is one possibility. E dagger F is outside N of S. That's OK. Then we can correct. What if E dagger F is in S? So if E dagger F is in S, then it turns out that E and F act the same way on code words. And you'll prove this in one of the tutorial problems today. Okay, and that in turn means that we don't need to distinguish them. They're errors, but they do the same thing to the code words. Okay, if they do the same thing, well, we can just correct them the same way. Okay, does everyone understand that? So that's the situation we're in here. So if E dagger F is always outside N of S, then we do, in fact, have a unique error syndrome corresponding to each error. And then we can just say, given the error syndrome, we know it must be this error. We'll invert it. On the other hand, if we have this minus S occurring sometimes, And that means there'll be some pairs of errors that we can't distinguish by the error syndrome. But we don't need to, because they act the same way. And actually, if you think about it, the 9-qubit code already had this showing up. Right? Because in the 9-qubit code, well, if you have a phase error on the first qubit, well, 000 plus 111 becomes 000 minus 111. If you have a phase error on the second qubit, that's the same. 000 plus 111 still becomes 000 minus 111. And you can see that in the stabilizer here, because Z1, Z2 is in the stabilizer. OK? So the 9-qubit code is already an example of needing this minus S. And we say, in fact, if the minus S condition is needed, we say the code is degenerate. Because it means that the different errors are doing the same thing. And degeneracy is a kind of unique property of quantum error correcting codes. It doesn't happen with classical error correcting codes. And it makes quantum coding theory a bit more complicated than classical coding theory. So for instance, there's some results that we know about classical coding theory that we don't yet know how to generalize to quantum coding theory. OK. So let me define a little bit of notation now. So we like to encapsulate. Obviously, to totally define the code, we need to write down the stabilizer. Oh, it's worth saying that not every code can be defined in terms of its stabilizer. In some cases, well, you can always write down the code space and say, what is the stabilizer of this code space? But in some cases, that's not enough to uniquely specify the code, that there won't be very many Pauli operators that are in the stabilizer. But if you go the other way, if you say, here's a stabilizer, let me take the maximum subspace that's consistent with that stabilizer, then that does define it. And that's called the stabilizer code. The 9-qubit code is a stabilizer code. There's lots of other interesting stabilizer codes. So what we like to do is have some shorter way of kind of describing the important properties of the code than just writing down the stabilizer every time. So one thing is we'd like to encapsulate the ability of the code to correct errors. So we can do that in terms of something called the distance. And so for stabilizer code, the distance of S is the minimum weight of some Pauli that's in N of S minus S. Okay, so N of S minus S, remember, is a set of undetectable errors. And the weight is the number of qubits on which the Pauli acts non-trivially. Right? So for instance, if you have X tensor I, tensor X, tensor I, that would have weight 2. And so then the distance is the weight of the smallest thing that's undetectable. Okay? So the distance, remember, so this set of undetectable errors is a set of operators that map code words into different code words. So the distance then is telling you how many qubits you need to act on to get from one code word to a different code word, the minimum number of qubits you need to act on. Okay. Then looking at this theorem over here about stabilizers correcting errors, we see that a code can correct t errors on up to t qubits. If the distance is at least 2t plus 1. Right? Because suppose you have a code that has distance 2t plus 1, and you think of two errors, E and F, that act on t qubits. Well, then E dagger F can act on at most 2t qubits, right? Because it can't act on any qubits that one of them, neither of them is acting on. So the weight of E dagger F is at most 2t, so that's less than the distance. And that means that E dagger F cannot be in N of S minus S, okay? Which is the condition that we needed to say that we can correct those errors. Questions?
What's WT?
WT, so that's weight. So that's the number of qubits on wait E on which E acts non-trivially. So it's the identity on some qubits and X, Y, or Z on the others. Okay? Other questions? Okay. So then we have the distance, which tells us how many errors the code can correct. And so we like to summarize the properties of a code with these three numbers, n, k, d. And we put them in these double brackets to indicate that it's a quantum error-correcting code, in particular stabilizer code. And in this listing here, n is the number of physical qubits. K is the number of logical qubits. And then D is the distance. Okay? So the 9-qubit code, that would be a 9-1-3 code. We know it has to be 3 because it corrects one error. I guess it could be more than 3, but it's not. Okay. So now we use this stabilizer formalism to show you some more examples of code. So for instance, we have the 5-qubit code. So the 5-qubit code is going to be a 5-1-3 code. And the stabilizer, so I like to write these stabilizers where each row is a generator of the stabilizer. And so the 5-1-3 code is going to have 4 generators, right? Because k is equal to 1. We have 5 physical qubits, n is equal to 5. And the number of generators r could be n minus k. The 4 generators, so they're going to be x, z, z, x, I, x, z, z, x, I, x, z, z, and z, x, I, x. Okay, and you can check that these 4 generators all commute with each other, which is needed, right? Because we need, when we write down a stabilizer, it needs to be an abelian group. What's a little more tedious is to check that all of the different 1-qubit errors have different error syndromes for this code. So how many 1-qubit errors are there? Well, there's 5 qubits and x, y, or z possible for each of those. So that's 15 1-qubit errors, plus the identity, no error. So that's 16 errors. And here we have the error syndrome consists of four bits. 0, 1 for each of them tells us whether we have plus 1 or minus 1 eigenvalue. So there's 2 to the 4, 16 possible error syndromes. And so in this case, the number of error syndromes is exactly equal to the number of errors. So we're using up all of the error syndromes. For 9-qubit code, we had some extra error syndromes, which is why, for instance, we can correct one error on the first set, one bit flip error on the first set of 3, and another bit flip error on the second set of 3. But in this case, we use up all the error syndromes. And this 5-qubit code is actually the most efficient code to correct one error and encode 1 qubit. one general error. Obviously, if you just want to do a bit flip error, we saw three qubit code. Okay? Okay, I want to introduce one more code, which is a bit less efficient, but has some nice properties that make it useful. This is a 7-qubit code. You can read it. Basically, what we have here is we have six generators. So this is going to be seven physical qubits and one logical qubit. And these generators come in two sets. So one of them has all X's and I's. The other one has all Z's and I's. And in case you can't read these, the Z's are in the same places as the X's are. And so basically what's happening here is that we've taken a classical code and we've converted it into a quantum code in a very particular way. And this classical code, so this part here, well, these Z's correspond to measuring the parity, say this operator corresponds to measuring the parity of these four bits, right? Whether the number of ones is odd or even. Right, because every time we have a 1, we get an eigenvalue of minus 1. So we have minus 1 to the number of 1s. So if the number of 1s is even, we get eigenvalue plus 1. If the number of 1s is odd, we get eigenvalue minus 1. And taking the parity of some set of bits, that's something you can do for a classical bit string. Okay? And classical error-corrected codes, at least the classical linear codes, they work by defining sets of parities and saying the code words should have even parity for that set of bits. And so then these three generators just encapsulate the same conditions that a classical error-correcting code, a particular classical error-correcting code, would make. So this classical error-correcting code is called the Hamming code. Now, in the classical case, we only need those three conditions because we only need to correct bit flip errors. But in the quantum case, we also want to correct phase errors. And so what we do is we take the same code, in this case, the same code, and convert it into a quantum code, not by putting Z's, but by putting X's. So we're doing the same thing in the Hadamard rotated basis. Okay? And then by the same logic, this thing could correct one bit flip error, because it's a classical error correcting code that's designed to correct one bit flip error. And this part here can correct one phase error, because it's exactly the same thing with phase qubits. Okay? So what we have here is we have two codes, C1 and C2. And each of them corrects one error. So we can correct one bit flip error and one phase error. And therefore, we can also correct a Y error, because that'll be on both. And so this thing corrects one general error. So the code has distance 3. Okay. So this construction is called the CSS construction. So the 7-qubit code is particularly nice. In the general CSS construction, you can take two classical linear codes, C1 and C2, and put them together. They don't have to be the same in general. And then the distance is going to be at least the smaller of the distances of these two codes, right? Because if C2 can correct T1 bit flip errors, or let's see, C1 can correct T1 phase errors, and C2 can correct T2 bit flip errors, then well, the minimum of T1 and T2 is going to be the number of general quantum errors that we can correct. Actually, you can get slightly more sometimes because of degeneracy. So for instance, the 9-qubit code is an example of that. But that's the most general case. Okay. But of course, you can't just pick arbitrary C1 and C2. Why not?
has to be abelian?
Has to be abelian, right. So when we pick generators of stabilizer code, it's just not going to work unless they all commute with each other. And, well, these things are always going to commute with each other, right? Because z's commute with each other. And these things will always commute with each other because x's commute with each other. But these things might not commute with these things. Now, in this case, they actually do. You can check that. And in general, we need some condition on C1 and C2. I don't really want to go into it, but just in case somebody out there is familiar with classical error correcting code, the condition is that a C2 dual could be a subset of C1. Okay, if you don't know what that means, don't worry about it. But okay, so that's it for error correcting codes. I can take questions on that, and then we're going to talk about fault tolerance. What happens when you start to apply these to do gates and to do computations using error correcting codes? Are there questions on this? Okay, you'll have a chance to practice some of the stabilizer code stuff in the tutorial. So let's move on to talk about fault tolerance. Maybe I'll just abandon this side. Okay, so for fault tolerance, things are much more difficult than just for error correction. So for error correction, we said, well, Alice does some encoding. She can create whatever code she wants. She sends it through the quantum channel to Bob. There's some noise in that quantum channel. That causes some errors. And then Bob receives it, and he can do his measurements. He can do everything perfectly. But now, in a real computational situation, where errors are occurring all the time, even while they're doing the encoding and decoding, and even the gates that they use might not be perfect, okay? And so they can't completely trust anything they do. They have to find some way to deal with the errors, nevertheless. So so fault-tolerant protocols are designed to take care of this. So the idea is we're going to have states that are encoded in quantum error-correcting codes, but we're going to be very careful about the kinds of gates we do, so that the errors that occur will be errors that we can correct. So in particular, one thing we need to worry about a lot in fault tolerance is we need to be careful about error propagation. So what is that, and why do we have to worry about it? Well, suppose we do a CNOT gate between two qubits. And suppose those qubits were supposed to just be 0 and 0. Well, then the outputs that we get should be 0 and 0. OK, so that's simple enough. But now suppose there's been a bit flip error here, and instead of 0, we have 1. OK, well, what output are we going to get now? Well, before, the 0 didn't activate the C0, but the 1 will activate the C0. This is even assuming the C0 itself is correct. But then the output state will be 1-1. So whereas before we had a bit flip error on the first qubit, now both qubits are wrong. So this is what I mean by error propagation. The error has propagated from the first qubit to the second qubit. Okay? And actually, so classically, this can happen too, of course, if you have errors during computation. But quantumly, it's even worse. Because classically, if the error is in the second qubit, nothing can happen to the first qubit. I mean, assuming the gate itself is fine. The error doesn't, can only propagate forward along the CNUT. But in the quantum case, it can also propagate backwards. And the problem is that it's phase errors that propagate backwards, and those don't occur classically. So now let's imagine that we had the state plus plus and did this CNUT. Plus being 0 plus 1, so it's an eigenstate of x. So whether we do the bit flip here or not, the second qubit won't change. So the output we get is plus plus. But now suppose we have a phase error in the second qubit, and the actual thing here was minus. Well, that means that when we do the bit flip here, minus will have an eigenvalue minus 1. So we'll get a phase when that happens. So when this thing up here is 0, this stays the same. When this thing up here is 1, we get a phase of minus 1 down here. So in other words, this thing goes from 0 plus 1 to 0 minus 1. And this thing is also minus. So this is an example of the phase error propagating backwards through the CNUT from the target to the control. Okay? So error propagation is going to be a real serious problem in quantum computers, even more so than it would be in a noisy classical computation. And so why is it a problem? Well, suppose we have a code, like the 5-qubit code, or the 7-qubit code, or the 9-qubit code, that corrects one error. And suppose that an error happens at some point. That's inevitable. Sooner or later, there'll be an error. And then a little bit later, we do a controlled knot between 2 qubits of this code. Well, even if the controlled knot that we do is itself perfect, it can still propagate the error that occurred earlier. And now instead of one error in the block, we have 2 errors. Okay? And the code can't correct 2 errors in general. So that's potentially a problem, right? That could be something that causes it to fail, even though there was only 1 error to begin with. Okay? So what we're going to need to do is figure out some way to get around that. Yeah. Okay, so you might try to do that, but the problem is the error correction itself involves some gates, and those gates are also not going to be perfect. And moreover, there's another problem that I haven't mentioned here, which is that the gates themselves could fail, right? And so if you have a CNUT that involves 2 qubits, then if that CNUT fails, then possibly both of those qubits would be wrong. So what we need to do is something a bit more clever. I mean, we will want to frequently do error correction to stop errors from building up. But we're going to need to be a bit more clever about how we arrange the gates. And so in particular, whenever possible, we're going to like to use something called transversal gates. So the idea of a transversal gate is that the ith qubit of a block of the code can only interact with the ith qubit of other blocks. So for instance, it's not OK if we do a controlled knot between the first and second qubit within a single block of the 7-qubit code. But it is OK if we do a CNUT from the first qubit of one block of the code to the first qubit of a different block of the code. Then even if an error propagates, or if the CNUT fails, that'll cause errors in the first block, in the first qubit of each block. But each block is a separate 7-qubit code, and each block can correct one error by itself. One error in each of 2 blocks, that's acceptable. 2 errors in one block, that's not acceptable. OK, so what do transversal gates look like? Well, so imagine we were doing it just for 3 qubits to make it easier to draw. They look something like this. OK, first qubit interacts with the first qubit, second with the second, and third with the third. OK, yeah. Can we then make every gate transversal? And unfortunately, the answer is no. that on top of transversal gates, we're going to need something else that doesn't fit into the simple structure. There's not really enough time to go into the whole theory of fault tolerance. It's pretty complicated. I also haven't told you, for instance, about how to do fault tolerant error correction when the gates themselves are faulty, and how to prepare states fault tolerantly and measure fault tolerantly. So that's a whole big topic in itself. But let me just say it can be done. So we like, again, to put as many parts of these protocols to be transversal as possible. But there's all, to get the full set of operations, we're going to need to do something beyond that. And those things, unfortunately, get to be pretty complicated. One thing that is true is that the reason I introduced the 7-qubit code is that the 7-qubit code is particularly good for transversal operations. It lets you do the controlled knot transversally. It lets you do the Hadamard transversally. It lets you do a part of a four-phase rotation transversally. But unfortunately, that's not a universal set of gates. You need to do something more. But nevertheless, this makes the 7-qubit code a popular choice for fault tolerance. Okay, so then let me finish by mentioning one of the main results of the theory of fault-tolerant quantum computation, which is the threshold theorem. So what does the threshold theorem say? Basically, it says that using fault tolerance, there is some constant error rate that the experimentalists need to achieve. And if they can get below that error rate, then we're set. Then we can apply these theoretical constructs to do good computations. So in particular, it says there exists this threshold error rate P sub t, such that if the error rate per gate or time step, so each gate can fail with some probability, and if the qubit sits around for a unit of time without doing a gate, it can still have an error, right, a storage error. The error rate per gate and time step is below P sub t, then arbitrarily long reliable quantum computation is possible. Okay, and what's more, we can say something about how much overhead is needed to do this. So in particular, we can, maybe I'll put it over there. So for the threshold, we can achieve error rate epsilon per logical gate using an overhead that is polynomial in the log of 1 over epsilon. Okay, and by overhead, I mean the number of extra qubits per logical qubit, say. And similarly, number of extra gates per logical gate. Okay, so what this says is that if you want to do a computation of a very, very long quantum computation, say it has big T steps in it, well, then in order to get the right answer with a good probability at the end, we need an error rate that's about 1 over T. right, then the probability of getting through the whole thing without having any errors, any logical errors, is very likely, or at least reasonably likely. If we do, you know, 1 over 2t, then it's even better. And so to do that, well, the overhead we need is then polynomial in the log of t. So this is somebody was asking yesterday about whether the extra qubits and stuff that were needed for error correction and the extra gates were going to overwhelm the quantum advantage. But you can see now that they don't, right? Because in order to, you know, if you get an exponential speed up over the classical computation, so like take factoring, the best factoring algorithm takes something like, you know, 2 to the n to the 1/3 time, best known factoring algorithm, to factor an n-bit number. Whereas the best quantum algorithm is Schrödinger's algorithm takes, you know, less than n to the third time. And once you throw in error correction, well, n to the third time, we're going to need an overhead of some polynomial in log of n to the third. So the overall number of gates we'll need is about n cubed times some polynomial in log of n. Polynomial in log of n, that's not going to be very much. Well, in principle, that's not very much. In practice, to get this thing started, there's some relatively large constant factors. So in practice, it is pretty painful to have to do all this fault-tolerant error correction. But it's certainly much better than having to deal with the errors. So anyway, so the threshold theorem is really important because it tells the experimentalists that to do arbitrarily long computations, they don't have to make their gates better and better and better. They just have to get below this threshold error rate. And of course, there's been a lot of study as to what the actual threshold error rate is. It depends a bit on the assumptions you make, but under the most optimistic kinds of assumptions, it can be as high as like about 3%. Okay, so that's 3 errors per 100 gates. And that's something that's definitely experimentally achievable. Maybe under more realistic assumptions, you need a bit lower than that, 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 4. But that's also probably experimentally achievable, though not so easy. Okay, so this tells us that there's no theoretical barrier to building a quantum computer. In practice, it's still difficult, but you know, assuming quantum mechanics is right, then we should, given enough time and effort, be able to build big quantum computers. Are there questions about this? Yeah. Kind of somewhere in between. It depends on the assumptions, but not really on parameters. So for instance, if you imagine a quantum computer where you can do gates between arbitrary pairs of qubits, and that's just one step, then the threshold error rate will be one thing. On the other hand, if you say, well, that's not realistic, the qubits will be arranged in 2 dimensions, and we can only do gates between nearest neighbor qubits, then the threshold will be a bit lower. Okay, so that's not exactly a parameter, but it's a property of the computer. So it depends on that kind of thing. And of course, there's some additional assumptions behind this threshold theorem. So for instance, you have to be able to do parallel gates on a large fraction of the qubits in the computer at once. And the reason for that is that, well, if you don't do that, then if you have to do qubit, you know, error correction on qubits one at a time, then by the time you get to the end and have corrected all the qubits in the computer, the ones that you started with have been sitting around for a really long time, and errors have accumulated there. Okay, so there's some assumptions that you really need to get this threshold theorem at all. But those are not too impossible, those assumptions. Yeah?
Also, I didn't really understand why the required error rate of the computation should depend on the expected amount of time that the computation is going to take. That's the theory.
Oh, yeah. So you don't necessarily have to do that, but you say you can just set this epsilon to be whatever you want. Say I want the error rate per logical gate to be epsilon. But then after I do t gates, the probability of having a logical error that has happened on some logical gate is about t times epsilon. Okay? And then, so if t times epsilon is greater than 1, or significantly greater than 1, then the probability of getting through the whole computation and getting the right answer is pretty small. But if t times epsilon is much less than 1, then it's very likely we can get through the whole computation and still get the right answer at the end. And so that's all I'm saying, is that you want to choose epsilon to be small enough that the probability of having a logical error is small, somewhere in the computation.
So why is the threshold error rate not defined to be per game?
Right. So there's a subtle difference between what I wrote here and what I wrote there. So this is the error rate per physical gate. So these are the gates we do on the individual physical qubits. This is the logical error rate. So this is the gate on logical qubits, which are encoded. Okay. So that's like yesterday when we said for that classical repetition code, the error rate per bit was p, but then logical error rate, the probability of decoding wrong, that was order p squared. So it's the same distinction I'm making here. Yeah.
If we use error correction codes to send a message,
mm-hmm.
is it detectable or discoverable by sending someone in between? Because we're using.
We'll talk tomorrow about quantum cryptography. But right now we're imagining that Alice and Bob agree on what the error correcting code is. That's not really secret, but we're imagining just trying to protect it not from an intelligent adversary, which is kind of the environment, which is unfortunately a bad enough adversary as it is. And it's probably introducing errors more or less at random. And so we're trying to deal with that kind of thing for now. And then tomorrow we'll worry about the cryptographic situation. Okay, that's probably it for today.